From California to Virginia, Indiana to Pennsylvania, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the nearly $2 trillion Biden Build Back Better bill is the largest welfare increase in American history. So says Robert Rechter of the Heritage Foundation. He is here to explain. Congressman Scott Perry has been elected the new chairman of the House Freedom Caucus. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Vice President Kamala Harris's job approval rating is even lower than President Biden's. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores why the Veep is so unpopular. And with Republican-leaning states restricting abortion and Democrat-leaning states welcoming it, the nation has become divided. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about it on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Biden and congressional Democrats are pushing for the biggest expansion in welfare spending in American history. That is the practical impact of the so-called Build Back Better bill. Here with details is Robert Rechter. He is a senior research fellow in domestic policy studies at the Institute for Faith, Community, and Opportunity at the Heritage Foundation. Robert, welcome to American Radio Journal. Robert, in your recent analysis of the president's so-called Build Back Better bill, you have referred to it as the largest welfare increase in U.S. history. Why do you call it that?
Well, for one thing, I have data on the entire welfare system going back to 1929, and I have the war on poverty, I have the invention of Medicaid, I have Obamacare. This increase, which would be at a minimum about $200 billion a year almost instantaneously, is by far, far greater than any other increase, just out of sight in comparison to all other increases that have ever occurred in the welfare system. It is a monumental increase. We could really think about it as sort of the war on poverty phase two. And it's just so large, people can't even begin to grasp it. This bill takes the entire Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is basically the public housing. It increases the entire department budget by 50% overnight. This is just an astronomically large increase in spending.
The spending has been pared down, if you will, from $3.5 trillion to, what are we now, at about $1.9 trillion?
Right, that's a complete illusion, and it's a gimmick. The way that they allegedly trimmed this spending down, that spending is budgeted over 10 years. And what they did was basically keep almost all of these enormous spending initiatives intact, but they terminate them or phase them out in the fifth year or earlier. And in order to hide the actual cost of continuing this, your audience might ask, once you create a federal program, how many times does it actually get terminated? The answer is virtually never. I'm not sure ever. And so what they feel is that if they can put these huge spending increases in place, they will stick and they will never be removed. And they're hiding the actual cost by pretending that the programs somehow disappear in a few years. If you take all of these spending initiatives and actually were to fully fund them through the 10-year period, the cost is $2.5 trillion just on the welfare component of this bill alone.
So this is new spending. Talk for a minute or two, Robert, about what we already spend when it comes to welfare or related anti-poverty programs.
Right. All of this spending is piled on top of an enormous welfare system that we already have. In 2018, before COVID, sort of the baseline, the United States spent $1.2 trillion on what's called means-tested welfare spending. These are programs targeted toward poor and low-income people. We have over 90 different programs in the government, and they provide cash, food, housing, medical care, social services to low-income people. It does not include Medicare or Social Security. $1.2 trillion, it's about 5% of the whole economy is already spent on this, and they're just piling hundreds of billions of dollars of expenditures on top of that.
Back in the Clinton administration, there was some modest reforms of means-tested welfare programs. This new Build Back Better bill, does it leave those intact, or does it largely undo what occurred then?
No, it completely overturns welfare reform. Bill Clinton was elected on the premise that he would end welfare as we know it, which meant he wanted to get the government out of the business of paying families not to work, particularly of paying single mothers to spend decades on welfare, sort of in isolation from the rest of society. And so we got rid of the main cash program that paid them not to work and replaced it with a program that had a greater orientation toward work. This completely overturns that, and it puts the government for the first time in 25 years back in the process of paying families not to work, which will be very harmful to them, because every child really needs to grow up, should have the right to grow up in a family where there's at least one working adult that give them an example of how to participate and succeed in society. And again, this is just piling on top of an enormous welfare system that already exists. If you take, in 2018, the average family with kids that the government defines as poor, in fact, that family already has, before these new increases, it has $21,000 in cash, food, and housing coming from the government on average, another $17,000 in medical care, and $5,000 in social services. Then on top of that, the family also has $22,000 in public education spending. Now, that's not means tested, but it is paid for by the taxpayer. So the average family, before we do this expenditure, that is, quote, a poor family with kids, actually has $65,000 a year in support coming directly from the taxpayer. And then on top of that, that family also, many of them work, and on average they have about $18,000 in earnings. And so this family that the government defines as poor is, in fact, has about $83,000 in economic resources, close to $60,000 just cash, food, housing, medical care, and services, just leaving the education out. How in the world does the government define this family as being poor? Well, the reality is that almost none of that spending that the taxpayer puts money into for food stamps, for public housing, for Section 8 housing, for the earned income tax credit, none of that is counted by the government when the government counts income or poverty. And so, therefore, the family ostensibly has virtually no income. And basically, when the government puts out a report on poverty every single year, and when it puts that report out, almost all of that $1.2 trillion that the taxpayers put up to support low-income people and families is invisible. It's not counted at all. It's off the books and it doesn't exist. And therefore, they create an impression that we have no welfare state in the United States, when in fact we have an enormous welfare state, but it's effectively hidden from the taxpayers. And Biden is using this misunderstanding, this misperception based on absurd data to pretend that we have a meager welfare state and therefore we must spend billions and billions and billions more. But you know, the real irony is that if we spend this $2.5 trillion of new spending, it won't be counted either. Not one dime of this new spending will be counted as having an effect in reducing poverty or as having an income effect. It's all invisible. It's all off the books. And in a few years, they'll come back and say, oh my goodness, look at all the poor people we have. We need to spend more money. But by that time, they will have raised the total resources of these families from $83,000 to close to $95,000 a year, and they still will be telling us how poor they are.
We have been talking with Robert Rechter, a senior research fellow in domestic policy studies at the Heritage Foundation, that, of course, in Washington, D.C. Robert, tell us just a bit about Heritage. You've written extensively on this subject. Where can folks go on the web to find that information?
They can go to heritage.org. Just put in my name, Robert Rechter, and probably the biggest increase in welfare spending, and you will get a number of reports that document what I'm saying. It's really not controversial, but the Washington establishment doesn't want you to have this information.
Robert Rechter from the Heritage Foundation. Robert, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have a number of very interesting developments that surround Congress this week. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to begin with Congressman Scott Perry, in as much as he happens to be my congressman, a major new position on the horizon for him. Want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, this week, the House Freedom Caucus, which is an organization comprised of roughly 40 House conservatives that lead the charge for really all the freedom issues in Washington, they got together and through their board, they went ahead and elected Congressman Scott Perry to be their next chairman, which will take effect in January. And, you know, Scott Perry is a guy that obviously has been a big, big part of the conservative movement, not just in Pennsylvania, but in our entire country for his entire time in Congress. And we're really excited about the opportunity that's in front of him to lead that organization of House conservatives, many of which the Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action, or Super PAC, have helped elect.
As we head into 2022, obviously we do have congressional elections, and in some states we're now starting, Scott, to get the results of the new maps because of redistricting. That has occurred in the state of West Virginia. It does pit a couple of incumbents against each other. What is the Club for Growth seeing in that district?
The bottom line is, in West Virginia, they had three congressional seats, and due to reapportionment, one of those seats left for another state, and now West Virginia will only have two congressional districts. Within that, they went ahead and pitted Congressman Alex Mooney against Congressman David McKinley, and they went ahead and protected Representative Carol Miller. So with McKinley coming up against Alex Mooney, it's really night and day, black and white, in terms of their record when you're looking at the economic opportunity, liberty, and freedom issues that the Club for Growth so much cares about. And in this instance, Congressman Mooney is such a solid, consistent conservative, while David McKinley is one of those 13 Republicans that actually voted with Nancy Pelosi and advancing the bipartisan infrastructure bill just about 10 days ago.
A number of Democrats have been bailing out of Congress, announcing they are not running for re-election, which ought to be a bit of an advantage for Republicans heading into the cycle. Particularly in the state of North Carolina, we had a notable retirement. Can you fill us in on that?
Part of the reason I think you're seeing some of the Democrats call it quits is, number one, they feel that a Republican wave is in their face and they don't want to get overcome and drowned. Nobody wants to go out with a loss. It's better to kind of put your tail between your legs and admit defeat before it happens. And because of redistricting, a lot of these congressional districts are taking shape now, and we've seen redistricting lines in North Carolina that indicated that G.K. Butterfield's seat was definitely at risk, going from a strong Democratic district to now basically being a straight-up toss-up. And there's right now one Republican candidate that sort of leads the field. She ran against Butterfield last Congress. Her name is Sandy Smith, and she's running once again. She's done a good job raising money. It remains to be seen how the filing turns out, whether there are other competitive candidates that jump in, and we're going to be watching that race closely as it certainly becomes a Republican pickup opportunity when this incumbent decides to really not give it a real fight.
Scott, the bitterness within Congress hit another level again this past week. A member was censored. Are we in a time now where it seems like Democrats and Republicans in Congress are really more interested in how they can attack and vilify each other as opposed to trying to actually get something positive accomplished?
We saw it at the beginning of the year with Marjorie Taylor Greene and Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats stripping her of her committee assignments. That was the first step. And every time that something controversial happens, it just seems like they jump toward the heaviest precedent that they can rely upon. And in this instance, with Congressman Paul Gosar of Arizona, the Democrats went ahead and voted on a censor resolution that was supported actually by two of those rhinos, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. But every other Republican, including all the Republican leadership, held together defending Congressman Gosar against the attacks that the Democrats had. Mr. Gosar and his office put out a video that was really an anime cartoon that was supposed to be in jest, and it showed Gosar as sort of a quirky leader. And within that video, there was a questionable attack against President Biden and also AOC. And so the Democrats use that as an opportunity to completely come after Gosar, who's really known as this quirky congressman that, you know, he's just got one of those different personalities. He's a lot of fun with social media, and he's a kind of the meme congressman is what I would call him. Not mean, but meme, M-E-M-E. And that's what this was intended to be. I don't think that he had any thoughts about actually injuring or hurting President Biden or AOC. So partisanship right now is about as strong as it's ever been. I was speaking with a senator yesterday morning, and he's fairly new, was elected in 2018, and he said that the Democrats won't even talk to him at all. He's never had a conversation with Chuck Schumer. He's never had a conversation with Dick Durbin. And really, when you think about the institution supposed to be the greatest deliberative body in the history of mankind, being our United States Senate and then also our House of Representatives, when members aren't even talking to each other, I'm not sure how they can ever come to agreements that aren't partisan. And I think that's why you're seeing Democrats really trying to hold the line on these partisan agreements, whether it's the Biden infrastructure bill that did pick up some of those rhino Republicans, or whether it's sort of the Green New Deal, reconciliation, Build Back Better proposals that Joe Biden has put out there that aren't intended to get any Republican votes.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington. If anybody wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
All right, thank you.
Vice President Kamala Harris's job approval rating is in the tank, and White House aides are sniping at her. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports she has never had strong approval numbers.
President Joe Biden's approval numbers have been trending steadily downward for months now, and high inflation certainly not helping things there. But if the president's approval numbers are in bad shape, then you don't want to see what the vice president's approval ratings look like. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're actually going to shift the focus a bit away from the Biden administration and the Build Back Better plan and all of that intrigue to take a quick look at what's been happening with Vice President Kamala Harris, because she was a rather unpopular politician even before she became vice president, and quite frankly, nothing seems to have changed. In fact, it looks like her ratings, her approval, her popularity has actually gotten worse. Earlier this week, when President Biden went to sign the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that passed Congress a week ago, Vice President Kamala Harris was there, and she was also going to give a speech. And when it came time for her to step up to the microphone, the White House's public address announcer that was sort of emceeing the event actually introduced someone else in her place, introduced Heather Kurtenbach, who was a union activist who also happened to be there that day. It just created sort of an awkward, funny moment where you had the vice president standing at the podium ready to speak, and the White House public address announcer was already inviting the next speaker up instead. Look, that doesn't mean anything. We shouldn't take any sort of big picture lesson out of this, but it was an interesting, awkward moment that comes right around the same time that some media outlets have been reporting about this friction that exists between the Biden administration and the vice president at the moment. CNN reported last week that key West Wing aides have largely thrown their hands up at Kamala Harris and her staff, while Harris's confidants seem to believe that she is being deliberately sidelined by the White House. Now, all that palace intrigue, I don't know. I don't find it all that intriguing, to be honest. It really shouldn't be all that surprising either. Pretty much all presidents and vice presidents have rocky moments in their relationships at some point in time. And given the results of this month's elections in Virginia and elsewhere, coupled with the fact of inflation, and polls showing that Republicans are gaining a big lead in the early phases for next year's midterms, it's understandable that Democratic fuses are growing a bit short right now. It's sort of like a baseball team mired in a losing streak. The White House needs someone to blame for the recent run of misfortune, and the finger-pointing in the clubhouse is now spilling into the media. But Harris's problem isn't really that some anonymous staffers in the White House are snarking about her to reporters. It's the fact that polls show the vice president to be deeply unpopular, far less popular even than Biden, whose approval numbers have been underwater since August. A USA Today Suffolk University poll earlier this month found that just 28% of voters approve of Harris. And as Politico noted in their coverage of this poll, even famously despised Vice President Dick Cheney never saw his approval ratings tumble that low. Even among Democrats, Harris is not performing well. When you just look at Democratic voters in that USA Today Suffolk University poll, 63% of them say they approve of Harris's handling of the vice presidency. By comparison, 83% of Democrats say that Biden is doing a good job as president. So even amongst her own tribe, she is not exactly making a strong case for herself. And these low approval ratings make Harris a convenient scapegoat for the White House. They also likely reflect some of the political and policy missteps that Harris has taken during her first year as vice president. She was put in charge of the handling of the administration's diplomatic efforts with the so-called Northern Triangle countries. That's El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And that's where many of the refugees that are currently seeking to cross America's southern border are coming from. Now, that's a tough assignment, to be fair, but Harris has really bungled it. I mean, there's really been no progress made in that area at all. She was also called in as a last-second surrogate to help gubernatorial candidate Terry McAuliffe in Virginia, and we all know how that went. McAuliffe lost to upstart Republican Glenn Youngkin. Now, none of these things are singularly debilitating, but there's an undeniable pattern here. Harris's aides can complain all they want to CNN about how the White House is putting her out there on losing issues in the wrong situations for her skill set, as CNN quoted one anonymous staffer in that piece on Sunday. But the real problem here is that Harris just seems pretty ill-equipped for so many situations. And at a time when politics mostly just makes people angry, there are few politicians that are genuinely well-liked, but being disliked isn't necessarily a political death sentence. Indeed, some politicians do quite well in the role of being disliked, of being the heel, if you will. Perhaps none of them do it as well as former President Donald Trump. Others survive being unpopular because they hew to certain principles, and being principled means occasionally you have to do an unpopular thing. But Harris actually has none of that to fall back on either. She flamed out during the presidential primaries in part because she just couldn't make a strong case for herself. The problem for Harris is that she's ultimately a law and order politician in a party that no longer has much room for cops or heavy-handed prosecutors. Her attempts at evolving her image to being a progressive prosecutor just haven't landed well. They come off as being disingenuous and unconvincing, and she's now tethered to a sinking ship of a presidency, and she doesn't seem too interested in helping bail out, only complaining that her feet are getting wet instead. And no, I think some people want to chalk up Harris's poor numbers or criticism of her political performance to sexism or racism, and of course that might play a role in how some voters see Kamala Harris, but there are plenty of popular politicians out there, at least more popular than she is, who are racial minorities and or women. That means that Harris's popularity problems are her own, and any attempt to push them off into some sort of identity politics scheme really, at least to me, is unconvincing. Now, the good news for Democrats here is that Harris's time on the national political stage, from her flailing presidential primary campaign in 2019 through her current struggles as vice president, suggest that she's not much of a threat to eventually run and win the presidency, and that's probably actually good for the party. It means that other people who are more popular with better ideas will have a chance to rise in place of her. And honestly, that's probably good news for the rest of us, too. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the Biden administration, Congress, and everything else happening around the country at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The U.S. Constitution is silent on the topic of abortion, which is why laws regulating the procedure should be left to the states. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Roe versus Wade is facing challenges unlike ever before, all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, the chances of abortion being sent back to the states are higher than ever. And as that prospect looms, pro-choice politicians are stepping forward to do everything within their power to protect unrestricted abortion. Leading the charge at the state level are the likes of New York's new pro-choice governor, Kathy Hochul, and Governor Gavin Newsom of California. Vigorously supported by President Joe Biden, Hochul and Newsom are militantly committed to battling the Texas effort to limit abortions to the time of the unborn child's heartbeat. The Texas action outrages Joe Biden, who's promised to throw the whole of government against it. The bill infuriates Governors Hochul and Newsom, who have responded by offering their states as destination centers for women of Texas and elsewhere to come for abortions. Says Hochul, quote, "Abortion access is safe in New York. To the women of Texas, I want to say I am with you. Lady Liberty is here to welcome you with open arms. We will help you find a way to New York." Hochul is also careful to include birthing persons, as she calls it, in her invitation. As for Gavin Newsom, he vows to make California a, quote, "reproductive freedom state. These are dark days," unquote, says a dire Newsom. What's happening with states like California and New York is something that many of us have long suspected. Namely, if Roe versus Wade is reversed or curtailed by the U.S. Supreme Court, abortion will be turned over to the states, as it should have been long ago. For the record, Roe is ridiculously based on a right to an abortion invented and extended from a so-called penumbra or shadow of a right to privacy lurking somewhere in the arcane recesses of the Constitution. No, I'm not exaggerating. In fact, neither abortion nor even the word privacy are mentioned in the Constitution. No, not one time. Even as the rights and protection of life is mentioned three times in the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. Yes, shocking but true. Now, one can certainly argue that when the framers mentioned life, they weren't thinking of abortion. No doubt that's correct. But still, a pro-lifer looking for a right to life in the Constitution clearly has a little more to grab onto than a pro-choicer looking for a right to abortion or even privacy. Roe versus Wade is a legal absurdity that any sane jurist not jaded by ideology would concede is utterly without foundation in the U.S. Constitution. The reality is that the Constitution is silent on abortion, which is why the federal government should have never enshrined it. It should have been left to the states. This was actually something that Judge Robert Bork tried to explain to senators like Joe Biden and Ted Kennedy and feminists and liberals everywhere over 30 years ago during his confirmation hearings, and for which Bork was called everything from a misogynist to a gargoyle. But there's a very good chance that that's exactly now where we're headed. If so, what will happen to abortion in America? Well, some states will embrace it far and above others. Which states? The answer is pretty simple and predictable. Go to political maps of presidential elections and look at the so-called blue states versus red states, that is, Democrat states versus Republican states. The firmly Democrat states, especially on the West Coast and Northeast, will become America's abortion states. They will roll out the red carpet for so-called abortion rights. For states like New York and California, that process has already begun. The governors there are eager and excited. They will fly the Roe flag as premier destination centers for abortion. This is where we seem to be headed in America, abortion states. Behold, the abortion states of America. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WJXY AM and FM, along with WNMB AM and FM in Myrtle Beach, North Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.